over a few weeks, we've been looking at wisdom from the Buddhist tradition, and in particular, we've been basing it on living wisely, a book by Sangharakshita, Bhante Sangharakshita. And last week, Lilamani started us looking at the doctrine of non-self, the idea of non-self in Buddhism. So the Buddha taught many things during his long life. And one of these was called the three marks of conditioned existence, and I've just written them up there. Impermanence, insubstantiality or non-self, and unsatisfactoriness. And reflecting on these marks deeply enough will allow us to approach and eventually attain to the experience of enlightenment. So these are three, these is a teaching that comes up again and again. The Buddha teaches this again and again. Last week, Lilamani was looking at non-self. I just want to say a few things she was saying, just to sort of remind us, let us know what this non-self is. Because it can be a bit confusing, or it can be misunderstood the wrong way. In fact, Bhante Sangharakshita says that no self or non-self could be understood as you simply don't exist. Okay, so that's not very good, is it? You know, it doesn't really make you feel any good, and maybe you don't want to practice Buddhism if that's what Buddhism is saying. So, however, what he says is what the doctrine is really pointing out is that you don't exist in the way you think you do. So it's not that you don't exist, it's that you don't exist in the way you think you do. So there's something a lot more mysterious going on, something bigger, something a lot more mysterious going on. In fact, there's another dimension to mind, to our experience, to consciousness, that is a lot more real than the one we normally inhabit. So this is what the Buddha was saying, this is what Buddhism is attesting to. And in contrast with this reality, the actual, this other dimension of reality, what we normally have, the waking consciousness, is more like an illusion. So, and seeing through this delusion gets rid of all fear. So the Buddha was saying that we can go beyond fear totally. Because all fear is to do with propping up the ego, preserving and protecting the ego. That's quite a thought, isn't it? That's quite a thought. That we could actually not just feel the fear and do it anyway, but actually go beyond fear altogether. And that's, you know, and the Buddha and other enlightened beings have done that. They've gone beyond fear altogether. So there's just nothing to be afraid of, because there's nothing to protect. So all fear is to do with protecting the ego. Another point Bhante makes is that he was talking about the experience we have when we have a very vivid dream. And it can seem totally real, can't it, when we're in the dream. It can feel very... well, vivid, alive, we're reacting, you know, there might be a tiger in your dream. I've had dreams, I go through phases of things, I don't know about you, I have animals in my dreams sometimes, you know, I'm attacked by a wild animal, and maybe it's just me. So you've got a tiger in your dream, and then you're scared, you run away, or whatever it is. And we identify with this figure, don't we? That, you know, we identify in the dream with this figure, and it feels very, very real. And it's only when we wake up we go, well, kind of, phew, it wasn't a real tiger, that's all right, or whatever it is, you know. And it's only when we wake up that we realize that we're sort of coming out of our dream life, and we realize that we've identified very much in our dream as we do with waking life. But it's not like dreams are inconsequential, are they? I mean, they've got a whole life in themselves, but they also affect our waking life. Have you had that where during the day the memory of the dream keeps coming back? You might have a really strong dream, and it's actually had a very big effect on you. So what Bhante's talking about there is that waking consciousness is only the tip of the iceberg. The mind has other dimensions. There's something else, a lot going on. And the dream life is just one dimension of that. And what Buddhism's pointing to is other dimensions of the mind that we barely touch on. But we can begin to go deeper and deeper into them through practice, through Buddhist practice, through meditation. We can begin to open up to different dimensions. And then finally, from last week, what Lilamani was saying also is identifying with the ego can be confining ourselves to a narrow band of the narrow band of the total spectrum of our experience. So using that metaphor of a spectrum, like a rainbow. So saying as if orange were the only colour and that other colours of the rainbow were unreal or imagined. So it's as if we just focus on one aspect. We just focus on the waking consciousness a lot of the time, as that's the only thing that's real. Whereas there's a whole load of other dimensions of the mind, of life, of consciousness, of the mind, and in the same way that there's many different colours in the spectrum. So he's saying that reality can only be reached through an expansion of consciousness, not simply focusing on our present experience. Again, I think that's quite an interesting area, isn't it? Because sometimes you hear that idea of focusing on your present experience, and that's really good, isn't it, to get in touch with all your senses. But Buddhism's kind of pointing out of that, we need to be aware of what's in the present, in our waking consciousness. But Buddhism is pointing towards something a lot bigger, a lot bigger. So Bhante is saying that although the ego is ultimately a delusion, it's describing an actual experience. So it's not saying we don't exist, it's saying we do have an experience. So ego, or maybe we talk about I or mine, is an actual experience. So Buddhism's not saying the experience you have is somehow wrong. They are real experiences. But he's saying that they're not the last word on the subject. As we were saying, something more is happening. Something more, mysterious is happening. And then the next thing I thought is just a really wonderful statement. Bhante says that it's probably better to see the ego as less of a thing and more as a way of functioning. So seeing the ego as less of a thing and more as a way of functioning. So I really, really like that. And in fact, it feels, almost the key sentence in the chapter. So often we concretize, ourselves, I, mine, the ego, and we think of it as a thing somehow, something fixed. But he's beginning to sort of unfold that and say, well, actually, ego is a way of functioning. And the rest of the chapter, he explores that more and more. So he's saying that transcending the ego, so quite often maybe this language is used of transcending the ego, can cause confusion. He says actually it's nonsensical, because talk of getting rid of something that never existed. And I just want to read from it, from the book. He says the language we use can be less than helpful when it comes to the ego. Expressions like transcending the ego create a lot of confusion by apparently fixing something non-existent in the form of an apparent object of knowledge. The result is nonsensical. We talk of getting rid of something that never existed, or even denying this object of intense interest and concern any reality at all. The ego, we say, is not real. If we're not careful, we can spend a lot of time talking about something that does not exist in such a way that it becomes more real to us than it was before we started making so much of it. So it's interesting, you know, the more we begin to talk about this, about transcending the ego, we're making the ego a problem. And then it's easy to kind of get caught up in our heads, isn't it, and really get quite sort of intellectual about it or cognitive about it and try and sort of say, well, what is this ego? Whereas really the Buddha is saying that, you know, the self is a delusion. So Bhante is pointing out that we can make it more real just by focusing on it. So he's saying the ego doesn't exist, but it refers to this genuine experience. And he says we have habits of selfishness, and our task is to transform these habits. So it's looking at ego as not so much a thing, but as a way of functioning. And he's saying you function as an ego when you are closed in on yourself, when you shut yourself off from other people. And conversely, when you are more outward going and expansive and engaging with the concerns of others, you are functioning from non-ego. Yeah. So that's, I really like that. So it's more of a direction, if you like. When you're closed in on yourself, you're, you know, being selfish, and you shut yourself off from other people, you're functioning as an ego, if you like. But the more we can be outward going, other regarding, and more expansive, and more concerned with others, we're functioning from sort of non-ego. I'm just wondering what you make of that. That sort of strike you.
I think that's a pretty nice way of putting it. If anyone's ever read any Eckhart, has anyone ever read any Eckhart at all? He talks about, I'm sure you'll have, he talks about ego as being a kind of almost like a evil sort of monster.
Mm.
He personifies it when he talks about it, like it feeds off, it wants this, it wants that. It feels useless if you do this. He talks about it like that. And actually, when you talk about it not existing, or at least talk about it in terms of a direction.
Yes.
I actually find that much more helpful.
Yeah. It sounds like, I haven't read it myself, but it sounds like you could really problematize the ego, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And almost you want to sort of jump out of your ego or somehow... destroy it or something like that, as if it's the problem. Yeah.
And it's definitely a sort of pathway to beating yourself up a lot.
Thinking about the ego as a verb rather than a noun.
Yes.
To suggest this process, and that.
That's right.
It seems to have it emphasises the possibility of change, doesn't it? Mm.
Yes,
you
exactly.
Can stop functioning one way.
Yes.
Mm. Decide to function in
another. Yes. Yes, exactly. That's a really, really good point. Yeah, it's process, it's verb rather than noun, and it's something we can do something about, as it were, yeah, by changing our behaviour. Yeah.
I think when you focus on other, you become other.
Do you want to say a bit more?
Well, you move out of being in you.
Hmm.
When you're focusing, you're thinking about someone else, you're thinking about someone else's needs, or
yes.
considering someone else, you're not in yourself, you're in them.
Right, yes. So you really, it's kind of an identification with other people. Is that sort of what you're getting at? So, no?
I would suggest that it's a balance, though, isn't it? Because you end up living vicariously through others, unless you know your own identity, which is connected to the ego. I mean, what's the Pali word for ego? Because I'm sure I put it in the call ego. I mean, the ego is on a psychoanalytic connotation.
So we tend to use ego in with the same as self. So the Buddha talked about self, non-self. Whereas we tend to use it in the same. Although, like you say, it's probably more psychoanalysis.
I think the longer you sit on this mat, that ego is ever changing. Like you said, the process.
I just want to go back to what you were saying, Caroline, about that. It's quite an interesting... What you made me think of was this sense of identification with other people. And it's very much, the Buddha would very much identify with other beings, other people, and really understand them, but also really feel with them as well. And in that sense, you're kind of going beyond yourself, as it were. I don't know if that was around what you were saying, but
yeah. I find it really difficult to. It's more of a feeling that I find.
I think it's quite a difficult language. It's just difficult talking about this, isn't it? Because
it's quite clunky.
Yeah, it's quite clunky.
Verbalize it.
Yeah.
But I think people know when they've had that experience because it's uplifting. I don't think it is about. I don't think it's about being self-sacrifice. So that's something different. I think if you're doing something that actually, when you're moving out towards someone that's not coming from being ego-based, you end up having a sense of feeling uplifted.
I think it's a good point, and going back to what you were saying before, I think this having metta there is really, really important, isn't it? And metta is self-metta and metta towards other people as well. So then it stops it becoming, sacrificing yourself, as it were, or martyrdom, etc.
I don't necessarily feel that it's wrong to sometimes make a conscious sacrifice. You can imagine very clearly if in situations with a close loved one or family members, just doing something.
Yes.
Or the obvious one, the mother-child relationship.
Yeah, of course. Yes, I think you're right. And
maybe it's just different ways of saying the same thing.
I guess it's... one could think about that, it could be sort of, you're sacrificing, if you like to use that language. I suppose the danger of turning into sort of martyrdom, that you're leaving yourself out. It's like doing the metta, but not putting yourself, not doing the first stage or something like that. But I take what you mean, we might put others, as it were, in front of ourselves, others' needs in front of ourselves.
But I think doing a conscious is the operative word, isn't it?
Then
you actually get that. I love that that example Bhante gives us, where he says if somebody you love needs or wants something and you willingly do it, there's a blending of wills.
Yes.
Because actually you want to do it. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a mother with that child, you want to, you'd want to do it, even though you're consciously sacrificing, you're willingly doing it.
Yes.
And I love that idea. Then Bhante says, you can no longer tell whose will it is anymore, but your wills become blended with the person you love or whoever is with their will. Maybe it's a bit like what Caroline was saying as well. And then the art would be to expand it, so it's not just your child, it's like everybody's child, keep expanding it.
Yes. So Bhante was saying that these two ways of functioning, one he's called reactive and the other one creative. And some of you might come across this mind reactive, mind creative. So reactive is when we sort of come in on ourselves. And he's saying, well, we might feel cold or hard, quite limited or restricted. And you, as it were, you're circling back on yourself. Whereas creative is the opposite. You're feeling more free, warm and open, expansive and flowing, and you're spiraling outwards and upwards. So it's a quite a different feel to the two modes of being there. Does that sort of, again, does that resonate? I was thinking about that exercise we did before the tea break. Did you have different feelings for those two different actions? You know, when you were selfish and when you were mother, when you were other regarding.
Yeah, I noticed when I brought to mind, I was sharing a sort of where I said something that just clearly wasn't true.
Mm.
And I suddenly thought, oh, I feel like everyone can see that lie.
Ah, right.
And
yes.
It was as if my body shrank and closed down on itself. So it was a visceral shutting.
Yeah.
Closing in.
Yes.
You really. There was something. So the selfishness was the sort of wanting to impress, wanting to sort of get something, and so that intention then played out with a sense of shutting down.
You felt a kind of less connected with
with
the person or the people. Yeah. That's interesting. You had a physical experience as well, like you say, visceral physical experience. Yeah.
Interesting actually, because when you feel embarrassed, it's kind of a similar feeling, isn't it? That real embarrassment feeling. It's like you feel a lot in your stomach, but the rest of your body kind of feels like it doesn't, like it gets smaller in your way. That might be something to do with your sense of self shrinking, or I don't know, not your sense of self shrinking, more, I don't know,
closing in on yourself.
Don't know how to finish this comment, but yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? I was thinking, because there's, I suppose there's different sorts of embarrassment, isn't it? You know, there's, it could be one way you feel reduced by it, but also there's times when you feel like you can feel sort of bigger from it as well. You can feel being seen. Maybe embarrassment's not the right word, but sometimes you can just feel like more open and connected. Maybe embarrassed not the right word, but. You know, where you feel more vulnerable, more open, and if you are sort of seen more, maybe.
We said, speaking about embarrassment in relation to the example about the lie,
I suppose maybe I read it in a certain way.
Say something about Kri and Lapitrapia in that regard, then, whether that would help to refine the positive shame.
So Hri is what you were saying is positive shame, and I'll bounce it back to you. Do you want to say a bit about it? That's all right. No.
Could I maybe draw it out a bit?
Yeah, please.
Because I don't think in saying that I felt exposed and both sort of. I think vulnerable is a good word. I didn't. Yeah, there's something that is a closing down, like you were describing the sense of embarrassment. But I didn't take it to mean that was a negative thing. So that sense of exposure is actually, well, it's okay. It's as you said, it's sort of liberating. Sort of seeing the intention for what it is. So yeah, for me that's a positive sense of shame, or a positive sense of being humiliated. So that for me would be, and that's an internal visceral feeling. but then and then the sense of being exposed, and in terms of what others would think, well, that's also potentially a positive shame as well.
Mm-hmm.
If it makes me less likely to want to tell a lie again,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of how I feel about it at the moment.
I suppose, yeah, we can draw something positive from it, can't we? I suppose with the exercise, I was just trying to get to your sort of the base. I think it's a really, really good point you make, Jed, actually. But I was just trying to get to the sort of the initial experience that you can get, kind of one of, as it were, contraction, maybe, whereas one against one of expansion. You know, when you've done, I suppose, using the other one, where you've just been generous with someone or kind, you can feel more connected with someone, more warm-hearted, maybe something flowing a bit more, etc. Yeah.
I've heard a number of people from the centre sort of use the phrase "the self is attention."
Could you say that again? The self needs.
The self is attention. I think I've heard Marsha Bandy say that a few times.
Oh.
And the self can be experienced as attention in the body.
Ah,
conversely,
okay.
You know, when you work on relaxing your body,
yeah.
it begins to melt away in meditation, and your internal experience becomes more expansive, broader, able to contain more.
Interesting.
Just drawing some.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because Bhante in the chapter does say it can be like a visceral experience, can be like a physical experience, something cold and hard in you, as it were, but not to sort of literalise that too much. But yeah, sort of the difference in experience between sort of an egoistic way of being and a non-egoistic way of being.
I've definitely felt like the contrast of the two experiences. Although when I did the selfish reactive mind thing, it definitely felt painful. It also felt familiar. So it was painful, but it was quite known to me.
Mm.
And then when I thought of the generous thing, which was very small, it was more pleasurable, but there's a slight kind of, it was unfamiliar, so it was a slight kind of, oh, I don't quite know who I am.
It was
in a funny way slightly less comfortable, you know, that there was a sort of something, although painful, a bit comfortable about doing the selfish thing, because I think, oh yeah, that's just, it felt very known to me. Whereas the creative thing had a bit of a frisson of, I don't quite know who I am.
You were moving more into the unknown there.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because the reactive, although it's the patterns are can be painful, can't they? They can be the known, so that's what we keep going round. It's like Maitra Bandhu said at the tea break, isn't it? Where thoughts do. You know, we just keep on having the same thoughts, and we don't make changes. And that other side, it's a bit of going into the unknown sometimes, doing taking the opportunity. Maybe we're on the tube and. Mm. We give up our seat. Maybe it's not something we initially want to do. Maybe it feels a bit like we shouldn't be doing it or something. Or we connect with someone on the tube.
I'll just say, as we've been thinking about appropriation, I kind of seem to have the sense that to appropriate was a good thing.
Oh yeah.
So because I'm working for me, I'm working for myself to draw onto myself to make things better for me.
Yes, yes.
And so this idea of approaching a kind of a conversation or business situation or something like with a kind of a sense of non-appropriation is a completely different feeling.
Mm.
And at first I'm actually... I remember being quite wary of that.
Yes, yeah.
Not doing this for me, what am I doing, you know?
I don't quite know what else to say. No, but how now you've sort of taken those steps, in the quality of your experience?
Just your, like your simple experience of being on the tube.
Yeah.
And thinking, well, it's best for me to be sitting here. It's better
right.
for me to be sitting than someone else to be
yeah,
sitting
yeah,
here. So
yeah.
I feel a bit strange. You know, I used to feel a bit strange about offering my seat.
Yeah, yes,
and
yeah.
I'm
yeah.
thinking, like, am I being a bit weird here? Like,
yeah.
something that's not for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is how kind of extreme it can be.
Yeah. So now, I mean, say if you give up your seat, do you feel differently? I mean, would...
Well, I sometimes do.
Yeah.
I'm feeling it.
Yeah.
Feeling more expensive.
No,
yeah.
I would do that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, a bit later in the chapter, Bante talks about this other mode, the more creative mode, as being more satisfactory. More, you know, it's more fulfilling. And I think that's an interesting point as well. So it's not, as it were, not self-sacrifice, as it were, but it's actually just a more fulfilling, you know, you can actually get pleasure, if you like, from giving up your seat, if you use that term. It's more, you know, satisfying way, because you feel more connected to the person who needs to sit down. Do you know what I mean?
I quite often think about doing it. Being on the tube, I quite often think about wanting to do something spontaneous like that in a situation with people I don't know.
Mm.
And then I get into a dialogue like, oh no, that's really embarrassing, I don't want to. I get embarrassed at that thought that I want to be kind to somebody.
Oh, yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Anyone else experiences that?
No.
That's what I'm going
to do. No. No. But we do have that, don't we? There's a sort of, I don't know if it's just an English thing, but you know, there is that sort of, it's a flight, or maybe even a London thing. It's sort of, goal, you know, it's a bit uncool to be kind, you know. So.
I just said that I always feel a great deal of gratitude when people let me have that seat.
Right, there you go. So, just I'm going to give another quote. It's such a good chapter. Chapter 2, if you don't read anything else from the book, read chapter 2, because of this. There's a lot of good stuff in it. So, it says, it's not as if there is a thing called ego that we have to worry about having and getting rid of. It's rather that there's a more satisfying way of living. So, yeah, I was just touching on that before. It's just saying, so is it getting down to our experiential sense of the actions, of the way of living? So is it more satisfying when we reflect on it, being more generous, more kind, rather than more selfish? Do we agree with that? Is that... Right.
It's no question
because
it's so obvious,
really.
Yeah. It doesn't feel good
to be horrible. Right.
It feels horrible and connected and open.
Yeah.
It's feels much better.
Right.
It's just no question about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And I suppose we put things in the way of being open to others, don't we? When we put London, you know, we're living in London. It's not culture, it's kind of lift each other.
Yeah.
For example.
Maybe get stuck in certain ideas of how we should be, or
I think time has a big thing element to it as well. Time.
Time. Yeah.
Because I was sharing my room with a friend of mine for 4 months. I was trying to be really generous and kind because he annoyed me quite a bit. And I'm just trying to be very open to who he is. And I didn't know who he was before I moved in too much. Mm. So when I moved in with him, I realised that was a big mistake. But I thought I'd be very generous and compassionate, try and understand where he's coming from, accepting for who he is, and really just be gentle and take it in. And he's got a very aggressive, assertive personality, not physically aggressive, but would always really be like, are you comfortable being here? Do you want to? Why wouldn't you like me? Blah, blah, blah. Really attacking, really sensing my discomfort.
at the same time I'm trying to be at peace and calm with it. Mm. So I thought that was really hard, and over 4 months I just tried to be okay at peace. Mm. I thought, what do you draw the line? Like, I'm not comfortable here, but I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
I moved out.
Right. sure.
Like, yeah.
Well, I think you're pointing out that it's, I mean, it's a whole area of Buddhist ethics. So it's a whole area of our behaviour and how we live. And it's not something that's straightforward. It's not something that we can have easy answers to sometimes, I think. And we need to kind of work it out, do, you know, reflect on what's the best for ourselves and the best for other people. So it's quite interesting.
You've got to be careful as well that it doesn't, you know, become self-righteous as well.
Yeah.
That's the other end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think a lot of people that give to charity, that can start to happen. So then they develop a huge ego because of that.
Yes.
That ultimate act of self.
Is
by giving.
Almost.
You start to feel, even a simple thing, give your seat up.
Yeah.
Very difficult not to start to think of yourself as some.
Yeah.
Someone special.
So it's almost like it's to do with the intention behind it, isn't it?
Well, it's very hidden, that one.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I guess, if we're giving with the intention of, oh look, people think I'm amazing, then, you know, so very much Buddhist ethics, the intention is very important there. So, you know, if we're kind of giving from more of a, you know, a better spirit, as it were. Yeah.
Kind of an anonymous charity, or
maybe.
Feel more comfortable if someone's given anonymously than someone who gets a big plaque
from
the hospital.
Yes.
My wing.
Yeah.
At the same time, it will be mixed, like, I always think that thing of. Well, because the other extreme to that was to wait till our motives are pure before we do anything, and then, like, die bad or doesn't get his seat. You know, at the very least, at least the other person does get the, you know, if we work on our intentions, like you're saying, and still keep giving,
then
probably them in combination, or it will come out in the wash, won't it?
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
It's about awareness, isn't it?
But it's awareness and action, I think. See, I would say, don't have the awareness, but don't hold the action at the same time.
No, but it's, I think, sorry, more what I meant was, it's even if you do the action, it's having awareness, but in that action, that intention and the motivation is going to be mixed.
Anyway,
that's the right thing. let's press on. So Bhante's saying the ego is a way of behaving. So in one way you're revolving around your own axis. I quite like that phrase, revolving around your own axis. That's the ego is revolving around your own axis. And it's a limitation placed upon your experience. And he says it's possible to become free of it here and now. And by behaving in a non-egoistic way, I think it was like what you said earlier on, by going out from yourself, by orbiting around something bigger than yourself. So we can actually, instead of problematizing the ego, we can actually begin to change by just acting differently, by deciding to, deciding to sort of going out from yourself.
What does that mean, orbiting around something bigger than yourself?
I guess for me, the first thing that came to mind was it's to do with sort of having ideals. I mean, in the Buddhist context, I guess it's to do with having, you know, the ideal of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and having something bigger than yourself to go for refuge to commit yourself to. A sort of bigger reference point. Otherwise, if there's nothing bigger, I think there's just it just becomes you, as it were. You know, we become the most important thing in life. Whereas if you've got some bigger sense of values, then you can well, make that the most important thing in our lives. I don't know, that's sort of how it meant to me.
I suppose that's kind of like, and going back to charity example, it could be like, sort of, I am about charity rather than charity is part of who I am. Instead of charity being like an accessory that I have.
Yeah.
It's more like I serve charity. Sort of I belong to charity.
I think that's good. You're sort of putting, giving yourself, to, like you say, giving yourself to the values rather than making it sort of, well, I'm so kind, I'm so generous. Good point.
The late Zen master Shunro Suzuki, in a book that collects a lot of the sayings and teachings, his students compiled it, Zen Mind Beginner's Mind. It said when you're doing something, burn yourself up completely.
Oh.
So, for example, if you're giving to charity, your thought shouldn't be so much that I'm giving to charity. It should be more the case that charity is happening.
It's an interesting that, isn't it? Sort of, well, burning yourself up, again, using a whole sort of totally different metaphor
about the ego,
sort of really giving yourself, almost self-surrender, maybe, in some sense.
And I think also having those set of ideals is quite important for when you're not, like, self-surrender isn't a part of it, or you're not acting with pure intentions. An example, I was about to start an argument with my boyfriend the other day about a slight misunderstanding about something, and I didn't want to be nice. I really thought it was wrong, and I could really sense myself getting kind of worked up, like, just that's not what happened, and you are just misunderstanding this, and I don't know why you think that I would say that anyway. And I just knew, and I could go down that route, which is kind of the route where I really wanted to go down, because this was totally wrong. But I had this little voice in my head, actually, something from Astana, when Zev, the Young People's Retreat, a while ago, the only appropriate response is love. And so I just had that in my head, and there's this real part of me that said, just have this argument, because he's definitely wrong. But because I had that ideal, it didn't matter so much that right at that moment, my intention wasn't pure. You know, I sort of just acted on that. I know you don't really feel like this is what you want to do, but you've got the bigger picture. And you have faith in that ideal being the right thing to do. So act according to that for the moment.
Yes.
And then, you know, hopefully down the line I'll be a bit more skillful and I won't react that way to him.
Things like that
happen.
Yeah.
But it still means you're sort of practicing and acting from the sort of place of yourself.
Yes.
You have this kind of inner self.
Yeah. So you kind of got confidence in that somehow.
Because it's not always the case, is it? That you know, it's not always about charity. You're really acting out, going out of your way to be nice to someone. You're also, you know, can be reacting to stressful circumstances or reacting to things particularly nice.
Sure.
So you're not always in a position then to be like,
I
love you, and it's going to be really nice.
I was sort of drawing on a couple of things you say when you started. You said you didn't want to be nice because he was wrong. I was thinking you could actually disagree. You don't have to be nice, do you? So you could actually disagree, but still love.
Yeah.
So that's another way of thinking about it as well. You don't have to, it's not like we've got to disagree and have the argument, or be nice and shut up, sort of thing. We can disagree and love, you know, so that's another way of thinking about it, isn't it? But I really like what you were saying with, you know, you sort of having confidence in an ideal and then really acting from that.
Can I ask what you actually did? Did you just...
so have this, like, little inner monologue going on, and that's happening very quickly, and...
I just chose not to immediately respond to him while I was having this little inner monologue work itself out.
Okay.
And then just actually realised that probably there was some people on his day. And I went, no, it was fine. Instead of having really strong feelings, maybe there was some lesson or something.
Yeah.
It's
terrible anyway.
Yeah, I just find sometimes it's just easier to apologise.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, I find that this is, yeah, seems like a lot. I think there's like a release there, like there's a, you don't have that baggage going with you.
I have a very similar experience to what you just said. So I was having this like huge fight with my friend, and it's been about 2 weeks in, and we haven't spoken to each other for that long, and then I've just had this dialogue running in my head, and then that night I was going to talk to him, and then I kind of had the intention that I want him to be sorry.
Just have to warn you that this is all getting recorded. So just before anyone says anything to me. Yeah, that's
it. And then it kind of turned into a sort of, okay, I just want him to understand what my... like where I'm standing, and it's not that I won't accept whatever he's thinking, but then it's just that this is where I'm at, and he needs to appreciate that this is where I'm at, given that I'm the person that I am. So
It's interesting, isn't it? I want to press on because we haven't got a lot of time left, but it's working out of the detail. So again, quoting from Bante, he says, instead of saying that the ego does not exist or that it's not real, you could say instead that to be constantly turning in upon yourself is not the most satisfying form of existence. There are better options available to you. Instead of saying to yourself, just drop the ego, you can say, let yourself open up a little, or even let yourself go. So that's sort of a different flavour. This sort of, instead of sort of, as it were, battling with the ego, we can just say, let yourself open up a little. So, it says that to the extent that you think of others with genuine concern, you are non-egoistic. And I think it's sort of touching on some of the examples you were bringing out here. So he's saying that thinking of, well, the example he says is your wife and child, but you can, you know, change that to any example you want, your friends and family. Thinking of them with genuine concern is actually a better way or a more effective way of realising the truth rather than just sort of reading about it and understanding it intellectually. I think that's quite a strong statement to say, you know. Of course, we need to understand things intellectually, cognitively, but actually acting, really genuinely bearing our the people in our life and really thinking about them with genuine concern is a more effective way of realising the truth, i.e. moving more towards, growth and development, towards the goals of Buddhism. And it is the people in our lives that we need to practice, don't we, with and live with, and it is this very much concern. I think probably he was addressing that, you know, sometimes people can come to Buddhism with very much sort of a very much an intellectual idea, and maybe they don't even meditate, and it becomes very, very heady. And I think he's very much addressing this. It's actually better to act, because that will enact change in ourselves, and we can begin to change ourselves. So he's saying that as a result of this spiralling outwards, this sort of metaphor he's using, spiralling outwards of one's being, one's experience of oneself is no longer fixed, rigid or closed. He's saying you become so expansive, so engaged with and interested in the needs of others that the possibility of going back to the constrained self-regarding behaviour no longer exists. This expansion is now irreversible. The whole momentum of your being is so creative, so outward looking, that to behave selfishly has become impossible. It would be against your very nature. And he's saying traditionally this is known as the point of stream entry. So wondering what do you reckon about that? He's saying that we take this momentum, we spiral outwards further and further, and there's a point of where it just becomes so much of our nature to do this, that to go back to self-regarding, selfish ways will be impossible. And I think if this is a reformulation of the Buddhist path, if you like, so stream entry, as it were, you're entering the stream that leads to the ocean of enlightenment. So it seems that there's no, as it were, no way back, but in a very positive way. What do you think about that? Do you think that's possible?
I think it sounds true in that, I mean, I'm not thinking of Buddhist examples particularly, but if you think about people that are Nobel Peace Prize winners or great activists or people that have really done things, you can't imagine them just kind of like stopping halfway through their mission or getting three quarters of the way through it or kind of go the whole way.
Yes, yes.
And just because they achieve each milestone, they don't kind of sit back and stop.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
irretrievable,
that path, trajectory they're on.
Yes, yes. It's like you've built up so much of a momentum of positive habits that you probably could go backwards, but actually if you've built so much of the momentum up, then it's less and less likely that you'd go back. Yeah. And like you say, there's some examples in like Aung San Suu Kyi, just incredibly inspiring examples of what she's done, and just being incredibly courageous as well under great threat, or Nelson Mandela or others. Yeah.
I don't think any of these people then, or, you know, when you're concerned with your own enlightenment or, you know, becoming a stream entrant or whatever, I think they all seem to be motivated by compassion and it's oblivious to them. It's just a natural reaction. And it's not against their nature, it's just compassion that's driving them to do this stuff.
Yes. I think that's another way of putting it, isn't it? Compassion or the regarding sort of identification with the needs of others and really acting in that basis to where you want to relieve suffering. Yeah.
Has anyone developed any kind of practice or any kind of method of entering more into that way of thinking? Because I think you get trapped into doing things the same way, but I mean, is there a way that you would suggest, I mean, we talk about meditation a lot, that possibly maybe something as structured as let's do two really generous things a day or something.
Right,
I mean, I don't know, I mean, that seems a bit anatomy, but
yeah.
I don't know, has anyone ever come across ways of actually really changing their behaviour and then really changing the way they feel and then really changing their relationship with themselves?
Well, I think the Buddhist tradition is that very thing. So meditation works on your mind. You begin to change your habits of mind, develop more and more positive habits of mind, the metta bhavana, and from the mind you're then beginning to affect the rest of your life. And if you practice Buddhist ethics, you're actually doing something very practical. I think it's what you're saying. I don't think it's too cheesy just to say that doing some two generous acts a day, because if you kept on doing that, that would make a big difference. You know, the accumulative sense of that, it would make a big difference to your life and others' lives. And the whole of the Buddhist tradition, I think, is pointing in that direction, and it's very, very practical.
I think if you want to think about livelihood as well, putting yourself in a livelihood where you're in the service of others, where that draws you out beyond yourself, in a sense, the demands of what the livelihood you're in keeps you going out to others. So if you, you can choose a livelihood that supports that.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I think living in a community is a really good opportunity to try and intertwine your lives with other people.
Mm.
It used to be in the movement that a lot of people used to share rooms.
Mm.
Like the chap was talking about, it's, I think that's a really kind of extreme way of really kind of sharing your life with other people. Especially, because normally it only really happens in the family or in a relationship. But I think community is a really good opportunity to do that.
It's interesting. There's
some wonderful stories from communities, aren't there?
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like there's different ways. I don't know if this is helping, but it's sort of different ways. There's a... What's sometimes talked about is the path of responsibility as well, which are quite, you know, if you take on something, especially in a, I don't know, say if you're a nurse or a doctor, then it kind of pushes you towards that selfless action, or, you know, working for a charity, etc. It's not guaranteed, obviously, there's lots of complications in there, but it could sort of bring that out in you.
Just from personal, I mean, I'm a teacher, I feel pretty self-absorbed.
Yes, right.
Every day, you know, the way my relationship with my kids and my relationship with planning and stuff, I think you can be put in a situation where you should be giving, but you can still be quite
ego.
To a question, I mean, that's what where the monastic branch of Buddhism is. I mean, like, monastic Buddhism, it is literally that the monks and nuns live in those communities because it is a structured way of reaching enlightenment. Because like getting up, having the discipline of getting up whatever time in the morning, 4 or 6 in the morning, and it's like doing everything mindfully until they go to bed, and living there for months or years. I mean, just to answer your question, that is one. A structured method. Not saying it's a way for everyone, but I was just answering your question.
I think it's very good, and I think those structures can work. And I guess what this points to is that these structures are only a guide and a help. So, you know, there's cases of selfish monks, for instance. There's cases of getting absorbed in, you know, being a doctor or a nurse or a teacher, etc. And so they can help. All these can help. But we need the motivation to want to change as well. And we need that motivation to... and I suppose this is why Sangharakshita talks about the centrality of going for refuge, you know, the centrality of making that commitment to change our lives, and to, you know, committing ourselves to growth and development. So I suppose it springs from there. You know, we might use those external, you know, conditions which can help us, but we need to have this central commitment, if you like, of wanting to change. I don't know. I'm just aware of the time, and we do need to wrap up. So, okay. Thank you. See you next week.